Parashas Vayeshev starts off by discussing the similarities between Yaakov Avinu and Yosef HaTzadik. And the basic similarity is that of all of the Shvatim, Yosef was the one who had difficulties, very difficult challenges in his life. It wasn't an easy life. He had to deal with the hatred of his brothers, just like Yaakov had to deal with the hatred of Esav. He was exiled, you know, from his family and from his homeland, you know, in Mitzrayim, just like Yaakov Avinu was exiled from, you know, his family, from Yitzhak, his father and mother, right, in the house of Lavan. They both had challenges that the other Shvatim did not share. And, you know, this is why, in some ways, Yosef HaTzadik is considered like one of the Avos. Where do we see this? In Halacha and in Minhag. So in Halacha, we know that Eretz Yisrael, each of the Shvatim, their children were not considered Shvatim. The children of Reuven, the children of Shimon, didn't get extra portions in Eretz Yisrael. Israel was divided. Reuven got one portion, Shimon got one portion, Yehuda got a portion, etc. Yosef didn't get a portion. His two children got a portion. So in other words, just like Yaakov Avinu's children got portions in Eretz Yisrael, Yosef HaTzadik's children got a portion in Eretz Yisrael. He was the Av. He was like one of the Avos. In terms of Minhag, none of the other Shvatim, you know, made their way into the Ushpizin on Sukkos. You know, Yosef somehow is on that list. Again, it seems that his status is like one of the Avos because of the challenges that he endured and that he overcame. So we also saw this a little bit, you know, from the first two psukim in Parshas Vayeshev. The pasuk says, "Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz migurei aviv be'eretz Kanaan," which means Yaakov settled in the land where his ancestors wandered. And Rashi is troubled. You know, why do we use these two verbs, settled and wandered? Why can't we say Yaakov wandered in the land where his ancestors wandered, or Yaakov settled in the land where his ancestors had settled? Why do we switch the verbs from settled to wandered? And Rashi's answer is that Abraham Avinu and Yitzchak Avinu, they were always wandering. They understood that life was basically, you know, one challenge after the next, you know, a mission, you know, after the next. And they never viewed themselves as settled. They never wanted to retire, to settle down, you know, to live in peace. Yaakov Avinu, you know, the tsaros that he experienced perhaps, you know, were of greater magnitude than those experienced, you know, by the earlier Avos. And at this point in his life, he wanted to just to settle down. He wanted to, you know, to live in peace. And, you know, Rashi says, but that's not, you know, the proper perspective for a tzaddik on the level of Yaakov Avinu. A tzaddik, you know, on that level, really should be constantly ready, you know, to move, you know, on to the next mission and the next and the next. Every second is so precious, what he can accomplish in every second. You know, to take a break, to take a rest, you know, might not be appropriate. And we pointed out that Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, said, based on this, that the point of religion is not, you know, to sort of like calm a person down, not mainly necessarily, or not only about, you know, calming a person and giving them this, you know, sense of peace. Religion very often is to challenge a person, to rise from one spiritual level to a higher spiritual level, and from that to an even higher spiritual level. And, you know, that's the idea, Yaakov Avinu. It's not just to coast. It's not just, you know, to plateau. It's really to keep on rising, to keep on overcoming challenges and growing, therefore, closer to perfection. And so he told a story that there was a guy whose parents were getting older, and he had to, you know, he had to deal with, should he take them into his house, which obviously would entail a lot of, you know, squeezing, you know, taking up space and being available for them, or should he put them into a nursing home? And this guy was, you know, debating it, you know, back and forth, and finally he decided it was too inconvenient, you know, to have them in his house, and he put them in a nursing home. But then he suddenly started to feel these, you know, pangs of guilt, and he figured, no, I'll go to shul. The rabbi will give an uplifting, you know, drasha, and then I won't feel so guilty anymore. And of course, you know, he comes to shul, and what's the rabbi choose as a topic for the drasha? It's kibud avaim, honoring parents. And, you know, Rabbi Shalom Karmi, who's a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, told this story as a way of illustrating these two approaches. In other words, you have the approach, I want, religion because it's going to make me feel good. It's going to uplift me, make me feel good about my decisions, no matter what they were. But the real perspective is that religion is there to challenge us to be our best selves. And even if that sometimes is a little bit uncomfortable, but ultimately the growth that we achieve, from that, is worth the
effort. The following student speaker comes to the main office, Noam Ash, Ariel Zanapar.
Again, Rashi also points out, that when it says Eile Toldot Yaakov, Yosef Ben Shvas Rishana, these are the children of Yaakov, and it only lists one. It doesn't list the other, 11 Shvatim. And Rashi explains that the reason for this is because, Yosef resembled Yaakov more than the other Shvatim. Like we said before, in terms of all of the difficulties that Yosef experienced, in his lifetime, those were very similar to the difficulties that Yaakov Avinu experienced and prevailed over. The pasuk continues and says that Yosef was 17 years old. V'hu na'ar es b'nei Bilha es b'nei Zilpa nishei aviv. He was a na'ar with the sons of Bilha and the sons of Zilpa. And the translation of the word na'ar means a kid, young person. And but a young person or a kid, sometimes you have that as a positive connotation. He's young at heart, and sometimes it has a negative connotation. Oh, you're acting so childish, and so this is actually a machlokas when the pasuk says v'hu na'ar, there's a machlokas about what connotation it has. Is it positive or negative? Rashi says that the words v'hu na'ar have a negative connotation. He was into narishkeits. He was into childish things like his appearance, how his hair looked, and clothing. Later on, there's going to be a coat that his father gets him. Yeah, clothing, appearance, hair, hairstyles. That's the narishkeit that Yosef was into. And Rashi interprets this pasuk as somewhat critically. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, however, explains this a little bit differently. And he interprets the words v'hu na'ar in a positive way. Sometimes people get older and they become cynical. They become, jaded. They stop seeing, all of the opportunities that the world, presents. They stop believing that their actions or the actions of their friends can truly transform the world into a better place. But what's, special about young children is that they usually have that very strong and fiery belief that anything is possible. The whole world, right? If only I work hard and do the right thing, I can grow up to be the president of the United States and I can transform the world. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said that this is, the idea of the hu na'ar in this parasha. It's the positive connotation of being, young at heart, constantly looking at the world as a place that can become much better because of my actions. And Rabbi Salvechik, in a different context, points out that we find that by Yehoshua as well. It says, "Umisharato Yehoshua bin Nun na'ar lo yamish mitocha oel." Yehoshua bin Nun, he was in his 40s at the time that the pasuk was written. The pasuk calls him a na'ar because, again, he was young at heart. He moved with that energy and enthusiasm that was born of a belief. That everything that he does, counts in the most meaningful of ways. And so there was a compliment by Yehoshua ben Nun, and it was a compliment also, according to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, when it comes to Yosef as well. He had that, idealistic view of the world, that sometimes, people sometimes unfortunately lose as they get older. The pasuk continues and says that Yosef brought Vayave Yosef et dibatam ra'a el avihem, that he brought their diba ra'a to his father. And we know the translation of the words diba ra'a, right, is lashon hara, what in modern parlance we call lashon hara, in Tanakh is called diba ra'a. And we talked a little bit, because it came up in the pasuk, about what is lashon hara. There's two basic definitions of lashon hara. The first definition is communication that causes someone harm. A person can suffer in terms of having their feelings hurt, in terms of having their financial opportunities hurt, in terms of having their social standing hurt. If a person communicates in a way, speaks in a way, writes in a way, communicates with body language in a way that causes someone else to be harmed, that's the first, you know, and most basic definition of Lashon Hara. However, there's a second definition of Lashon Hara as well, and that is speech or communication that spreads negativity. That's the second definition of Lashon Hara, communication that spreads negativity. And even if nobody gets harmed, by that speech, but if it makes people look at the world in a more, you know, negative way, pessimism, the glass is half empty, right? That also counts in a way as Lashon Hara. And so that's the second definition of Lashon Hara, even if no one is harmed, but it infects people with like a perspective on life, you know, that the world is a bad, dark, you know, gloomy place. That also could count as Lashon Hara. Who are the three parties that are harmed by Lashon Hara? So the Gemara says in Maseches Arachin that it's the speaker and the listener and the subject of the speech. And like, it's easy to see how the subject of the speech is harmed by Lashon Hara, because he could suffer financially, emotionally, in terms, socially, he could suffer because of whatever was spoken. But how are the speaker and the listener harmed by Lashon Hara? And so Rabbi Daniel Tzvi Feldman, explains in his book, False Facts and True Rumors, he explains that the speaker and the listener are harmed because they are infected with a negative, view of the world. You wake up in the morning and you only see the flaws and the imperfections and everything that's wrong with the world. You're going to be trapped in a very depressing and gloomy life. If you wake up in the morning and you look at the same scene, but instead of seeing the things that are wrong with it, you see the things that are right about it, you're living a cheerful life, and it's the same room, but the perspective that you take on it will determine whether you're living in an uplifted way or not. And when a person speaks Lashon Hara or a person hears Lashon Hara, they become infected with a negative view, that they see the bad in people, they see the bad in things, and they don't see the good. And that's the way that he explains that the speaker and the listener are harmed, because they become infected with this view where they look around them and everything they see is bad. What gift did Yaakov Avinu give to Yosef? The pasuk says it was a ksones pasim, whatever that means, some sort of a fancy clothing. Again, Rashi said before, Yosef was into clothing, right? It makes sense if his father wants to give him a gift, right? He's going to give him a nice piece of clothing. Now, this next question is very important, which is, why did the Shvatim hate Yosef HaTzadik? And this is something that most people have a misconception of, which is why it's so important to pay attention to the actual text of Chumash. Now, most people think that the Shvatim hated Yosef HaTzadik because Yaakov Avinu gave him the coat, and they were jealous, they hated him because, well, why should he have a coat and not us? But the pasuk, the Chumash is very, very clear that the fact that he had a coat is not why they hated him. In fact, the pasuk says that the brothers saw that Yaakov Avinu loved him more than all the other brothers, and that's why they hated him. Not because of the coat, but because of their father's, love. That's what the pasuk says very clearly. It wasn't the material, the object that he had. It was the relationship with his father, with their father, that made them hate him. The Gemara talks about, it says perhaps all of the tragedies that resulted later on from Mechiras Yosef could have been averted if something had changed. And so based on that, the Gemara learns that, from hindsight, something very important about parenting and about love in general from the Shvatim's hatred of Yosef. And what the Gemara says is, Al yishaneh adam bein habanim, that a person shouldn't single out one of his children from amongst all of his other children. A person shouldn't single out one student or one class from amongst all of his students or all of his classes. If your children ask, who's your favorite, right? Rabbi, who's your favorite student? Which class is your favorite class? The only appropriate answer is, they're all my favorite class. They're all my favorite student. You're all my favorite, children. A person shouldn't single out one child to be more favored than the other ones. And if Yaakov Avinu, the Gemara says, hadn't, singled out Yosef and shown him extra love and extra favor in a way that the other Shvatim was clear to all of them, then perhaps, the whole tragedy of Galus and Mitzrayim could have been averted. The Ramban, has a slightly different lesson that he learns from this. The Ramban says that love is a very powerful force, but power can be used for building, and power can also be used to destroy. And love, is a power, and love can be used, to build people up, but love can also be destructive. And the Ramban points out that, the moral, perhaps, of the story is that, Yaakov Avinu sort of just let love, run away with him. He let his love for Yosef run away with him. He just, if he felt that love demanded that he buy Yosef a coat, then he would buy Yosef a coat. If he felt that love demanded that he show Yosef an extra measure of affection, he would show Yosef an extra measure of affection. He surrendered, to love, and when the power of love is not channeled properly, it can be very destructive, as it was in this story. It created jealousy, and the jealousy created, the act of selling Yosef as a slave, and that eventually precipitated the Yerida and the descent of the Jewish nation into Mitzrayim. And so this is, it's a powerful lesson. Rabbi Soloveitchik told a story that underscored and emphasized this lesson. He said that he had a student who was very, very wealthy, and the student had a son whom he loved. And when the son, became, 17, 16, 17, 18 years old, and he got his driver's license for the first time, he kept on begging his father to buy him a fancy sports car. And the father came to Rabbi Soloveitchik and said, "Rabbi, what do you think?" And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, "Do not buy your son the sports car." The son kept on asking. The father, he really loved his son, and he wanted to make his son happy. He felt that that's what love, wanted him to do. That's what love demanded of him, that he could easily afford it. And so he ended up not listening to Rabbi Soloveitchik's advice and actually buying the car for his son. And tragically, what happened was is that the son took the car, he got into a major accident and actually died from that. The point here is that, letting love run away with you is not always a good idea. There are times, that a person can love somebody, but they need to contain that love the way that, a couple, that's engaged, till the chasana, hands off, right? Shomer nikia, right? Or because just giving wild expression to love is a very dangerous and destructive type of force. And the Torah teaches us the proper manner in which to contain love and channel it so that it's only used for building and not used for destruction. We pointed out that this is a similar moral that we learn from the story of David HaMelech and Avshalom. When it came to Shlomo, when he raised, when David raised King Shlomo, so there was love, but the love was balanced by a certain discipline. It wasn't, displayed in a thoughtless or careless or wanton way. But when it came to Avshalom, the Pasuk says, very clearly that David HaMelech never rebuked him. He never, took him to task. He never refused any request, that Avshalom ever made from him. And that gave Avshalom a feeling of entitlement, right? I can take anything that I want. My father's okay with anything that I want. He'll be okay with it. Until eventually he wanted to kill his father and take the crown. So the idea of David HaMelech and the love that he expressed for Avshalom might have been in a sense like a rerun almost of the story of Yaakov Avinu and Yosef HaTzadik. The destructive consequences were somewhat different, but the basic moral, according to the Ramban, is the same, and that is that love sometimes needs to be contained in order to make it safe and in the best interests of the person who is being loved. There was also a lesson. It says that when the Shvatim hated Yosef, lo yachlu dabro l'shalom, that they were not able to speak in peace. And Rashi points out over here that that this teaches us something important. That even in their hatred, the Shvatim were genuine. They were not duplicitous. They weren't tricking Yosef. They weren't smiling at him and pretending to be his friends. When in reality they hated him. But they actually they took him to task. They said we resent the fact that our father loves you more than he loves us, and by doing so they actually gave him the opportunity to try to make things better. That's a general rule that we have, hocheach tochiach es amisecha, that if somebody hurt your feelings, don't just go on and pretend that nothing happened, because then you're depriving them of the opportunity to try to make things better, to try to fix what they broke, to try to heal the feelings that they hurt. The proper approach is to, in a sensitive way, to inform them and make them aware of what they did and how they hurt you. And that way you give them the opportunity to make things up and to repair the relationship that was broken. And so that's what, you know, Rashi learns, lo yachlu dabro lishalom, that, you know, if you hate a person, don't pretend that you love him. If a friend, you know, hurt your feelings, don't pretend, you know, that everything is all right. In a very sensitive way, give them the opportunity, you know, to fix what they broke, because they'll be better off from having that opportunity, and you'll be better off as well. Again, it doesn't mean, you know, go and yell at them and abuse them for what they did, but it means in a kind and gentle way, make them aware that there's something broken that it's, they're the only ones who can fix. Now, the brothers, right, to their credit, you know, gave Yosef that opportunity. And Yosef actually perhaps tried you know, to fix things between himself and his brothers. And this is what the Aruch Chaim learns from the fact that Yosef told his dreams to his brothers. So again, the pasuk continues and says that, you know, that Yosef had a dream about, you know, the bundles of wheat, you know, that they were all in the field, him and his brothers, and they were bundling wheat. And then the bundles of the brothers got up and bowed down to Yosef's bundle. And it says that Yosef told a dream to his brothers, and the Aruch Chaim says, like, why in the world did he do that? You know, the dream clearly means that he sees himself as ruling over them. And, you know, isn't that likely to make them hate him more? So, like, why is he telling them something that's just going to increase their hatred for him? And the, you know, the Aruch Chaim's answer is, he says, very interesting. He says, when you share something personal, when you share a very deep, you know, personal experience, a dream, a longing, something private, with other people, you give those people power over you. Because, you know, if I tell people that, you know, my blanket has Sesame Street characters, you know, on it, so, you know, they can either take that confidence, you know, and say, okay, I'm your friend, so I'm going to keep it, you know, quiet. Or they can tell other people about it, which is going to make me embarrassed. Or they can make fun of me because of it, which is also going to hurt my feelings. And so, you know, there is a certain safety when it comes to not revealing personal things. If I dream of someday being the president of the United States, and I share that dream with somebody, so I'm giving that person power over me. Because they can ridicule me, they can make fun of me. You, the president of the United States, you don't have what it takes to become a president of the United States. Right? Or they could share, did you hear? He thinks that he's going to be the president of the United States. Isn't that ridiculous? He's delusional. And so when we share something that's very, very personal with other people, like a dream, that's giving them power over us. And we only do that with people whom we trust. Because if we don't trust a person, it's safer to just keep the things to ourselves. You know, maybe a therapist, maybe a very, very close friend, a parent, right, a sibling that a person is close with. The more personal, you know, the information, the more that we only share with people that we trust. And so the Aruch Chaim says that by sharing this dream with his brothers, Yosef HaTzadik was really trying to give them a message. I trust you. We're not adversaries. We're not fighting here. We're not enemies. We're all on the same team. And like, I believe so much that we're on the same team that I'm willing to bear my soul to you. And, you know, to share with you things that I wouldn't share with other people who I don't feel so close with. Again, it's unfortunate that the Shvatim misinterpreted this. They didn't, you know, they didn't catch that he was sort of extending this olive branch to them. And, you know, instead they responded, Hamaloch tim loch aleinu, you think you're going to be a king? You, a king over us? Nah, can't be. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. And they did, you know, make fun of him, you know, in a sense, you know, for having that dream. They didn't understand his telling them the dream for what it was, which was, you know, which was trying to make things better, trying to heal the hatred that had sprung up between them. And so that's the Aruch Chaim's explanation for why Yosef HaTzadik, you know, told the dream to his brothers. We pointed out there's a second explanation. That's the Sepharno's explanation. And I didn't want you to be responsible for the Sepharno's explanation, and I want to explain why. The Sepharno basically says, yeah, it was a narishkeit. He was into his hair, he was into his clothing, and he sometimes acted without thinking, and he told them things that just made the hatred worse. And you know, a lot of people were like, why aren't you teaching us? Why aren't you making us responsible for the Sepharno? And so what I explained was is that there's an approach to Tanakh that's called the Gova Inayim approach. And the words Gova Inayim, what they mean is high eyes. And the basic, you know, core of the Gova Inayim approach is looking down on the, you know, heroes, the heroic personalities of Tanakh, looking down as if, you know, we are high up, we're big tzaddikim, and we're qualified perhaps to judge the greatest, you know, people of all times and the heroes of our history. That's the basic, you know, premise of Gova Inayim, is that we, the students of Tanakh, are empowered and qualified to judge the heroes of Tanakh. And very often it leads to trashing great tzaddikim, which is a very a consequence which I'm unhappy about for a number of reasons, and I'll talk about those in a second. We pointed out that there's a similar phenomenon in literature that, you know, used to be, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein points out, it used to be, sorry, not Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Dr. William Kohlbretter points this out, that when a person studied a great, you know, work of literature, a classic, right, or a great, you know, short story or something along those like poem, the question that they asked it is, you know, what can I learn from this poem? How can I use the insight that it grants me to make myself into a better human being, a better mensch? And that was really the approach that people took, you know, to literature. What insight can this grant me into what it means to be a mensch, what it means to be human, and how can I take that and make myself better and more rich because of it, like rich in a spiritual sense. However, in the post, you know, modern era, the way that people analyze literature changed, says Dr. Kohlbrenner. And he says that in the postmodern era, there's only three legitimate questions that people, you know, that postmodernists consider legitimate when studying literature. You know, the first question is, how was the author biased by his class? The second is, how was the author biased by his race? And the third is, how was the author biased by his gender? And basically, that means that the people who are studying literature, who are reading, you know, the great classics and novels and short stories and poems, are setting themselves up as judges of the author. They're pointing out all of the flaws, you know, of the author. You know, and all of the biases and all of the reasons why they are so much more righteous than the author, because they're not biased the way that the author, you know, was biased. And that's basically, you know, postmodern literature. Instead of looking up, you know, to these great, you know, works of art, instead they look down on them. And Dr. Kohlbrenner points out that there's two, you know, dangers of doing this, and these two dangers are just as applicable to the Gova Inayim approach to Tanakh. And the dangers are basically, first and foremost, is that it makes us ashamed of where we come from. You know, these are heroes of our history. These are, you know, great people who were esteemed by generations of our ancestors. And what they created was beautiful, and what they created was enlightening. And the legacy, you know, that they left was, you know, was a legacy, you know, of goodness. They were exemplary role models. And if a person picks, you know, one little thing about, you know, their character or their conduct and seizes upon that, you know, and say, I'm going to judge them and find them wanting, they're basically transforming, you know, being proud of where they come from into being ashamed of where they come from. And, you know, whether it's, you know, in Tanakh and talking about the Avos and the Shvatim, right, and the Dor HaMidbar, we ought to be proud of where we come from, because we come from a great place. We come from a place, you know, where of wonderful values, you know, of being compassionate and generous and kind and fair. And these were what Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak Avinu, Yaakov Avinu, the Shvat, and Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron HaKohen, Dor HaMidbar, this is what they stood for. For a person to be ashamed, you know, of those heroes is also going to lead to a certain shame when it comes to promoting the values as well. And so we should be proud of where we come from, not ashamed. Right? The same thing in the United States, right? You know, there are people nowadays who say that we should be ashamed of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, right, and Abraham Lincoln, you know, because they were biased by class or by gender, right, or by race. And that's really overlooking the tremendous contributions that these people made, you know, to the world, and to our nation and to who we are today. These are not, you know, you know, people to be ashamed of. These are people, you know, history that we should be proud of. The second reason, the second difficulty with postmodern, right, or Gova Inayim approach is that this approach, it's Lashon Hara. Right? Again, you can look at the world and see the bad in the world. You can look at the world and see the good in the world. Lashon hara is speech that promotes negativity. We strive to do lashon tov, which is speech that promotes positivity. And so if there's an ambiguous story, a story that could be understood in two ways, like Yosef telling the dreams to his brothers, you could understand, hey, it was a narishkeit, it was dumb of him, right? Or you could say this was actually a heroic gesture. He bared his soul to them and gave them power over him to show his trust in them. So, Lashon Tov would say, focus on the positive. Look at things, look at the good in it. Don't look at the bad in it. And so that's the second, difficulty with the postmodern approach to literature, is that it's lashon hara. It's trashing, something when you could instead be focusing on how enlightening and beautiful it is. Why does the Torah then reveal, the sins of tzaddikim? It's impossible to go through this story without seeing a mistake somewhere. Right? There's got to be a mistake somewhere. Was it in what Yaakov Avinu did in terms of favoring, one son over the other? Or was it in terms of not containing his love? Was it Yosef in terms of, maybe making the hatred worse? Was it the brothers in terms of, letting the hatred run away with them instead of working it through? Somewhere there's a, why does the Torah tell us about the mistakes of tzaddikim? And so we talked about, two different reasons why the Torah does that. Number one, so that we can learn from their mistakes and not repeat them. And that's why Chazal say, we learn from Yaakov Avinu's mistake that a person shouldn't pick one child and let all the children know that this one is his favorite. The Ramban says we learn, right, from the mistake of Yaakov Avinu that we contain our love even when we wish that we could express it with a hug or with a kiss. But we understand, Shomer Nekiyah, right? That's, we contain the love. It's dangerous sometimes to let the love, be expressed in any which way. In terms of driving home those lessons, sometimes the Torah writes about the sins of tzaddikim. A second reason, that it's given, in the Mefarshim for why the Torah writes about the sins of tzaddikim is because that way, if there's something that is still broken, because of what happened, we can fix it. And you can look through Jewish history, where you see that there's a tremendous connection between, for example, Shevet Yehuda and Shevet Binyamin. And all the other Shvatim went off into Galus, and the only ones that survived are Yehuda and Binyamin. That's because Shevet Yehuda always was trying to fix, the sin of Mechiras Yosef by showing extra consideration and protection for the children of Rachel, Imenu, particularly for Binyamin. I'm not sure why not Yosef, but it was trying to fix what happened so that there shouldn't be, so that by drawing closer, between, the Bechara, the children of Leah and the children of Rachel, hopefully that way we can fix the rift and the sin as chinam, that was opened up, at that time between Yosef HaTzadik and the Shvatim. And so a second reason is to teach us, about what we need to do in order to fix, the mistakes that were made, centuries ago. We talked also about, what would have happened. It's an interesting, thing to speculate about. What would have happened if Mechiras Yosef had not taken place? What would have happened if Yaakov Avinu had not showed favoritism to Yosef? What if Yosef had not shared the dreams, with his brothers? What if the brothers had understood that Yosef was trying to make it up with them and to heal the hatred and responded in kind and tried to come closer, to him? What would have happened at that point? So there is a machlokas. Rashi seems to imply that the Jews had to go to Mitzrayim no matter what. And so, even if the Shvatim had made up, there would have been some other way that landed the Jews in slavery in Egypt. Rabbi Soloveitchik, however, says otherwise, and this seems to be the implication of the Gemara as well, that if Mechiras Yosef had not happened, and the Jews would never have been slaves in Egypt, he says. Yes, there was a prophecy that the Jewish people would be strangers in a land that wasn't theirs, right, for 400 years. And perhaps there would have been, slavery and oppression. But he says that prophecy could have been fulfilled in the land of Israel, because it didn't belong yet to the Avos, until the times of Yoshua ben Nun. And so the prophecy of being strangers in a land that wasn't theirs did not need to be fulfilled in Egypt. It could have been fulfilled in Eretz Yisrael, which is a land of the Avos, in the Holy Land, and they never would have had to go down to Egypt in order for that prophecy to be fulfilled, and it would have been done in a much more kind way. It wouldn't have involved as much suffering on the part of the Jewish people. And so Rabbi Soloveitchik really sees that if the mistakes that the Parsha chronicles had not, you know, been made, then the course of Jewish history would have been vastly different, vastly more pleasant.